Hello, and welcome to So Stories of Life. Tonight's theme is Fresh Starts and Other Terrifying Adventures. So is recorded live from the Tavern of Fine Arts in beautiful St. Louis, Missouri. So is a relatively young podcast created in 2013, celebrating the art of stories through spoken word, poetry, music, and performance. Our first story tonight is from one of our very first guests that we had at So. She is a poet and spoken word performer whose talent, voice, and stage presence knows no bounds. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Susan Trowbridge Adams.
Transitions. It's about having to shift from one position to another. It's about having to... And nobody likes to, so it's always a bad experience. Like, initially, every change is extremely painful. That's what I've noticed. Like, people don't like it when you move the furniture. And often, what precedes change is a very great deal of pain. My first piece tonight is called Say My Name. It's a rugged stretch in an open car, evil petroleum grus dust grinding into the eyes. And they run and run, and you are pinned at the pupil, red and wrecked and stuffed with caustic pearls of snot that feel like new widowhood. You hate your own nose. Your own breath feels like it might kill you. But it's on a leash. It's a CIA interrogation dog, and you've never been so thirsty, but there's more you know, so there's further to go. It's the long run under a brassy sky, heat pulsing off the rocks, your undercarriage tearing away in screaming chunks, because folks keep using this road when it's all mud. And now the petrified ruts are up to your axles. Just try breaking loose. You will walk in the wilderness, a new Christ, waiting for a totem animal vision. While your raw feet under your broken ankles leave a trail for predators and bloodhounds and forensics. And they will find you, and it will get, worse. You know it can't. You know, it can. It's a rabbit bunching through a four-wheel Superfund site, and a glowing vulture grinning at your sad little motions and his nuclear landscape sheltered and burning like a mine owner's arson. And honey, there's no signal out here. It's only target practice. You can hunch in a haunted shadow for a minute or an hour, but the sun will move. And then the swinging gobbets of meat dangling off your bones betray you, and every turd is a black pellet of scrapes. Everything is barbed in and around you, broken fingernails and wire hangers and pumice scouring away your fur and the temper you brought with you. You packed it tight. It's the wrong kidnap victim. Hope is a ruined well. You remember every time you didn't quit and thought that was a virtue, that can-do attitude. You pray for resignation enough for prayer. It doesn't end in a scatter of starlight. It ends in scorpions and no glass, not yours. Nothing here is yours or for you. Get out of your silly skin and your pride and your plans to keep living. The room, the joint, the self crumbling out of your mouth in dry heaves, a bridge of red stone, abandoned by people, by anything merciful. Here is holiness, but no surcease. You pay, and you shred in the polluted wind and move on. That was Say My Name. Thank you. Other transitions, and the vast majority of my personal transitions, have usually been accompanied by, if not triggered by, romantic transitions. I think those are the ones that we're, in fact, all mostly familiar with. This piece is called Telephone. There comes a time at the end of love, and sometimes in the crunchy forks, when you stop waiting for the telephone, even though you haven't stopped talking. Alone in the peopled ruts of memory, you say, finally, what you wanted to say all along. And only the walls and the cats listen stolidly, although they don't answer. But then neither do they contradict. Your truth lands wetly on the bed and in the bath. And with no one listening, you become no one, only louder and more polished. And you notice that after the final toss of the bottle message into the river of wrong that was carved for you by the party line and the static, your statement with no ears doesn't garble. It needs no translation. The gradual mutation of someone's brain does not move your puzzle around piece by piece until you no longer own the picture. Everything in this room is yours. You wrote every line and you have all the rights. And now, if you only existed, you'd have a story to circulate. That's Telephone. Thank you. My next couple pieces are pretty new. The first piece, obviously, was a lot about being at the bottom. This next piece is actually about being at the bottom. And I've called it Timmy. And those of you who can connect that to Lassie will understand what I'm talking about. One day, you wake up at the bottom. Mineshaft. Burned out basement. There are rock under your hams and stars in the narrow scuttle, but your eyes roll back. And you dream of grit under your fingernails and wall sections of sediment or muscle. Climb is a symbol in a foreign language. Dig is it's a grunt under the ribs. Sleep can be done. It's the bottom. Bottom isn't so bad. At least it's quiet. Days go by at the bottom in the silence, you kissing walls with your palms and remembering bad jokes. Whole days and hours of telling over potato chips or mittens. And when a squirrel blinks you on the head with his looted tulip bulb, you plant it in the bottom with the flat bones you found rummaging under your sternum to splint your leaky heart. And you think about red. Another day, when the limbs are bearing but awry, and the stars are grayer and those walls are firm. The bay of life hunting over the breach rains its chunk of smell into you, rousing you rumpled from rest at the bottom. And your ears turn west and you brace your feet and your shimmying fingers and you bruise your nose questing outward. And you blink your smooth eyes, and you quirk just half of your upper lip. And you nod bottom goodbye, and you button your coat. Thank you. One of the biggest, not the most important, I wouldn't have said at the time, but it proved to be a pretty significant transition for me, was moving away from white-collar work. I spent years and years in the nonprofit sector doing grant administration and business management, and I finally had what Paul Simon refers to as a little bit of a breakdown. And I don't know if it was compassion fatigue or if I just couldn't sit at that keyboard one more goddamn day or what happened. But that was that. You know, we parted ways, my office and I took a job doing longshore. I was just tired of process. I wanted something really physical. I wanted something really blue collar. I wanted not to have to explain myself to anybody. And I got lucky. There was a non-union shop in Seattle hiring. I didn't have the qualifications. I'm not a longshoreman in the union sense. Don't tell anybody. So otherwise, I couldn't have gotten that job. But it was really important to me emotionally. I was going through some kind of way. I don't know, it was just really bad. So this particular piece is only about 4 days old, so I spend more time looking at the page than usual. Please forgive me. But we're going to see how this rides. It's called Oceanfront Property. Everything around me steams. I have punched that time clock and stand at the edge of the world. It is silent. Here, silence made bigger by the sounds. The great blue heron, one-footed in the shallows, watching for flashing silver breakfast. The 6 a.m. estuarine moving water chucks against the pilings. Steel toes clang along the metal deck, two stories over my head, and my pink hard hat, and my clipboard, and my grief. They leave me be, these men and this chill and this quiet. Sun rises later over the ridges and out onto the western ocean, shushed with my nose cold and my body in motion. No one presses for my thoughts. No one requires me to be present. No one calls on me at meetings. There are, glory be to God, no meetings. Just an industrial beep, beep, beep. The matins of propane forklifts released from the warehouse like cattle on the pasture backing into the workday, and men on them kind and distant and curious. The only moral laws on the dock are clock in on time and stay till we're finished. No one presses their notions of ethics. The monastery of longshoremen was there before I came, and it will be there after I leave. Does it work? Is the only metric with which the scaffolding is judged. If it is sound, we will climb on it. Get her done. Larry stalks through the yard, brooding and angular, leaning backward, truckin', beaky and wet-eyed, his fluff of red Norwegian fringe a little sideways with the wind of sunrise, croaking at the loading crew, barking at the stevedore screeching cargo crane, swinging out of the hold. Larry don't give a shit, and he will tell you so. I don't give a shit. Just get over there and do it. Oh, this is a basket of fruit and a hot tub. That sentence is a month in Tahiti. Oh my God. No tiptoeing around the stage glass of egos. Only hierarchy and a job to handle. All the thousand sorrows in me tumble onto cargo are indistinguishable from rain, the fog, the hail, the face at work, pensive, red, and shielded is no one's business in the winter. When you stand at the edge of the world and become naked against your own horizon. That was Oceanfront Property.
Our next guest is also a return favorite of So. He's a circus performer, a clown, a juggler, a comedian, and one of the kindest souls I've ever met. When he approached us to tell his story for Fresh Starts, we were eager to hear what he had to say, expecting a funny clown scenario or traveling circus adventure. Instead, he surprised us with a starkly honest confession that captured our audience's attention and their respect. His circus persona is Judas Lynch. However, the story he's telling tonight is his own. This is Stuart Miner.
So, I believe in free will. I really believe in free will. I don't think that the universe just happened and there was a series of cause and effects and it's led us to where we are now. I believe in free will because I know what it's like not to have free will. See, I suffer from a chronic and progressive, and oftentimes for many people, deadly disease. See, I'm an alcoholic. So I know what it's like whenever you take a drink, and after that first drink, you no longer have the free will to stop drinking. It doesn't matter what you do, how hard you fight it, it won't happen. That one drink will lead to another, and another, and another. So I'm a very strong believer that there is such a thing as free will. What I'm about to do is do a drunkalogue. Something in AA, it's a story of where we were, what happened, and where we are now. And that where we are now leads to a fresh start. See, I had a high school sweetheart, and we got married about a year after high school, and that went along well for a while. She ended up running off of her college history professor. Yeah, laugh. Thank you. See, that was really painful. And it was a kind of sorrowful pain that you have to deal with, and you can deal with it one way or another. I dealt with it by buying a gallon of vodka, because it felt good not to feel that pain. And it felt good not to feel that pain night after night. So night after night, I drank until I just passed out. And it became a habit. But I was a very high-functioning alcoholic, so every morning I woke up and I cleaned myself up and I went to class. And so long as I could go to class and get good grades, I figured I don't have a problem. So I did. Semester after semester, I managed to pass out every night, get up, somehow get to class, and pass. I remember one story. It was the end of one of my semesters. We were doing the terms, and I decided not to drink for a few nights because I needed to study. So I didn't. I got to the class, and I was shaking so bad from withdrawals that I couldn't hold a pencil to fill out the test. I ended up going up to the professor and just saying I was sick and seeing if I could get it rescheduled, and luckily he bought it and said, yeah, sure, you can come back. So I did the test in his office after drinking the night before to get rid of the shakes, and it was fine. So I ended up passing that semester, and I got done with college, and I figured, I don't have a problem. I can get through college, and I can drink like this. But it inevitably got worse and worse and worse. I drink more and more and more and pass out earlier and earlier, sometimes get up in the morning and just, you know, for breakfast, have some vodka. Until I passed out somewhere around 11 and woke up somewhere 8 at night and was confused about what happened. But really, it's not the drinking that's sort of the problem. It's that fear that I never dealt with. And the fear sort of eats you up and keeps going. So as I got into other relationships and found people that I love, I didn't want them to know that I drank so much, so I do things to hide it, crazy things to hide it. And I don't think it's things you can understand unless you've gone through this. I would hide pints of vodka in my socks so that people wouldn't find them. I would put them under things in the house. I had a crazy stash of pints all over the house. I do magic sometimes, so I have magic equipment. So in trap doors, there would be pints of vodka. I didn't know what to do with all the empty bottles, and I didn't want to put them in the trash can because I wanted to hide from people how much I was drinking. So I would just have stacks and stacks of empty bottles hidden places around the house. I didn't want my neighbors to know, so whenever I took out the trash, I'd be like, oh, I can't bring out a sack of pints. So I'd put some cardboard on top of it with fear that people would know. And the best way that I found to deal with fear, the craziest way I found to deal with fear, that people not knowing, was I decided, you know, it's hard to control this when there's so many people in my life. So if I just limit the people in my life and I shut myself away, that's less people I have to hide it from. So it's less people to be afraid of. So I found myself withdrawing and withdrawing more, not calling people, not inviting people over, getting everybody out of my life that I could. That way I could hide what I was doing and not have to worry about it. I realized one point when it had got so bad that I couldn't do anything else, when it was last year during an ice storm. I thought I had enough vodka to make me pass the fuck out and, you know, be okay for the night, but I didn't. I didn't pass out. So I thought, I need to go get some more. So I walk out of my apartment, and just across the way, there's a Quick Trip. So I decide, well, I'm going to get over there. And I started walking, but it was icing, and I was drunk. So I fell down in the middle of the street and couldn't manage to get up. I saw a car coming straight towards me, and just lucky enough that it was icy, and that car didn't have much experience, apparently, because it fishtailed around me. And I somehow managed to get to the other side of the road and pick myself up. And like any reasonable drunk, I looked at my apartment, and I looked at the Quick Trip, and continued towards the Quick Trip. It wasn't until I sobered up the next morning that I thought, oh, fuck, if I don't stop this, I'm going to die. So you know what I did? Well, I figured before I stop this, I should go drink some more. So I did, and it carried on like that for a few more months until some friends of mine found it in their good nature to all get me in a room and be like, look, you've got a problem. It was true, I did. I knew I had a problem. Maybe I was just waiting for somebody to say it, because, again, that fear thing, way too afraid to do it myself. So I managed to get myself to a wonderful place. It's on Lindell, the Lindell Club. It's a sobriety club where I met great people. And I realized that my problem wasn't the drinking. That's what the problem caused, was the drinking. The problem was the fear. So when I stopped drinking, I didn't get sober. I just stopped drinking. Sobriety is more than stop putting the bottle to your lips. Sobriety is when you deal with that issue that causes you to put the bottle to your lips. So right now I'm proud to say that I'm not drinking. I haven't been drinking for about 15 days and 20-something hours now. Thank you. But I'm not sober, so I still haven't dealt with those issues. Sobriety is key. That's a story of transition and a fresh start. Thank you.
Our next story tonight was a last-second submission that totally absorbed me within the very first sentence. The story is remarkable because of its many layers of family dynamics, even more remarkable because the ending has yet to be written. I'm very honored to introduce to you a new friend of So, and one that no doubt you'll be hearing a lot more of in the future. This is Matt McGahey.
It's a pleasure to be here. I've got a piece that I just finished up, and I'm going to read to you tonight. Whenever my parents called a family meeting, it usually meant we were gaining another family member. And so, back in 1983, with five biological children, all boys, already underfoot, my parents thought it'd be a good time to adopt a child. My mom discovered Sarah on TV as a part of a news program called Tuesday's Child. Sarah was born into a family that couldn't care for her and her special needs. She was now 2 years old and in a foster home. The doctor said she wouldn't walk, talk, or function much at all due to hydrocephalus or fluid on her brain. Very soon, Sarah joined our family and became our sister, one of us. There was no question about her status anymore. We were not her foster family. This was not temporary. She was our sister. I often tried to help Sarah dress in the morning. At first, she could only get around by scooting on her knees, and she had trouble communicating. But to me and my brothers, she was just another kid to come along, to take care of, and eventually mess with. I'd wrestle to unbend her hand and her arm, which was constantly crumpled up, and we'd get it through one shirt sleeve with some effort and some tears. That might have been all I could have done at the time. I was six. My parents worked tirelessly, especially my mom, to get Sarah the therapy and assistance that she needed. She was already making great progress, exceeding expectations of doctors who had given her such a poor prognosis. After 2 years with Sarah, it was time for another family meeting. My mom was pregnant with her sixth boy, and we were preparing to leave the suburbs and move on to 32 acres of undeveloped land in North Georgia. We were thrilled. Six boys, one girl, a mom, a dad, and God on our side. We had reached the ground that my parents had been climbing towards since they were 18 years old, starting this family out. They claimed to have always wanted a big family, and I imagine that when they packed us all up to go start a life in the country, my parents felt successful. I believe that they were earnest in their desires and sincere with their intentions. I hope they were excited and proud. We built our log cabin, Mom continued to homeschool us, and we functioned like the traditional family that my parents had created. We spent so much time outside together. We'd run around in the woods, riding horses, climbing trees, swimming in the lake, playing football, waging war, building forts, breaking bones, slicing skin, and living up to our reputation as the boys. I can still see Sarah, you know, sitting in the sandbox as we'd run by. Why won't she swat that fly away? How long have Mom and Dad left her out here, I'd wonder. And then I was off. My thoughts and my guilt often centered on Sarah being stuck. Never once did I think about my mom or dad feeling stuck as they watched their six biological children grow, stay healthy, and develop normally, knowing that their adopted daughter would reach a plateau in her development soon. I wonder when they realized the implication of this. I wonder why they didn't realize it sooner. I wonder why it didn't stop them in the first place. Around 1987, we all started to transition into public school. Sarah, who was now six, was going to have a chance to be around peers. It was another step in the direction which would help her become more mainstream than anyone initially thought possible. Sarah was walking now with some assistance and was able to speak and communicate with some minor challenges. She could see, hear, smell, touch, taste, cry, yell, and be a brat and an angel and a tormented sister. I mean, really, you know, we had this storybook life going with a big, healthy, happy family doing quite well. My parents loved each other, and we knew it. We never wanted for anything. All throughout my childhood, my family was fiercely devoted to our fundamentalist Christian church, and we continued to hold firm to conservative values in our new rural community. My father was elected to be a county commissioner, and we were publicly heralded as a golden family. Our church community was our family, too. We spent a lot of time together, and I believed in everything that they told me to believe. It didn't seem false. It didn't seem like a metaphor. I struggled with faith, and when I was told to summon more faith, I did. I was so certain, so righteous at the age of 13. We took in homeless people. We fought against racism in our segregated county. We helped usher in the age of right-wing nut jobs as my entire family campaigned for Pat Robertson as he ran for president. I'm talking parades, door-to-door canvassing, signs, and bumper stickers galore. You're all very welcome. This had been our identity for so long, and it was only growing stronger. We operated like this, as one big family of seven kids and two parents for so many years. Then came another family meeting. We entered the living room with the wood stove burning and sat down casually awaiting word of my mother's pregnancy and pending birth of a baby, old news to us by now. However, what we were told was that we were leaving our church. This devastated me. How do you leave a church? My parents had always explained church not as a place or a building, but as the people. These people who we surrendered our spirits to, whom we spoke in tongues with, who we confessed our sins to. How do we just leave these people? Is it even legal to do this? Surely hell awaits us. I didn't understand how the church, full of my best friends, babysitters, mentors, and elders, how were we just going to walk away? I couldn't just walk away from my family or be told to leave, could I? I learned that we were indeed being asked to leave. My dad had finally grown tired of being told what to do, and after not falling in line behind a couple of seemingly benign directives, they simply asked or told us to leave. A betrayal I'll never forgive or forget. And I don't remember blaming God for it, but that's when I stopped believing in him. Quickly, we joined an Episcopal church and were accepted into the fold, and things, they did start to normalize again. We made friends, became altar boys, and reestablished our family brand in this new place. I was now drifting into my teenage years. My ambivalence about the world around me was growing. I added the word whatever to my lexicon and used it to express my opinion on all things. You know, maybe I wasn't quite as engaged in the drama of my family's day-to-day activities because I thought I didn't care about it. So, the next family meeting really it came down like an axe. It was 1991. We gathered in the family room. I think Mom knew she couldn't have kids anymore, something about tubes being tied. So we joked about what the big announcement could be, maybe a vacation this time. Here's the part where, you know, I wish I could start remembering things second by second, word by word, but it's a blur. The moments are so far gone, they escaped before I had a chance to grab them. You know, the buildup, the beating around the bush, the exposition, the talking in circles that normally accompanies such news is absent from my memory. Maybe it was never there. This wasn't a meeting at all. It was an announcement. A decision made, not a discussion had. Mom and Dad said that they couldn't take care of Sarah anymore. After nearly 10 years in our family, we had to take her to a new family. Maybe that's how they said it. Maybe not. My dad did most of the talking, I think. My mom was a silent partner at this point. We were to be the accomplices. My parents probably explained how it wouldn't be fair to Sarah to keep her in our family if they couldn't take care of her and that this decision was best for her. Yeah, we were used to that argument from whenever my parents spanked us, the old, this hurts me more than it hurts you, and it's for the best. Bullshit. I don't know if 5 minutes passed, or 5 days, or weeks, but the next thing I knew, we were dressed in our Sunday best, piled into our cargo-style van, and off to the Department of Family and Children's Services to say goodbye to our sister. Living in the country, it was very typical for stray animals to wander onto our property, mostly dogs. Once, though, a tame deer hung out for several days, walking up to us like it was our pet, frolicking with the other pets. However, we learned early that we were not the family that kept stray animals as pets. I mean, it's reasonable enough, considering the amount of human mouths to feed and the animals we already had, dogs, cats, horses, sheep, goats. My dad was not about to take on another random animal. So he was always quick and callous about putting a stray dog in the car, driving it down the road a good bit, and dropping it off far from our home. I know he was never cruel, and he only did it because he knew the animal didn't belong to us or with us and was not ours to care for. But I wonder if this is how he reconciled all of this with Sarah. And I've always struggled with what to call this. This dismissal, discharge, removal of a sibling from our family, this dropping off, this lack of control. I wonder if they would have tried to amputate one of my brothers instead. Would I have fought? Really fought? Blood to the death? I would do that now. If anyone or anything tried to take a family member, I would fight to the death. I didn't fight for Sarah. I was 14. I could have. I should have. Instead, I said, whatever. A year later, we had our final family meeting. After over 20 years of marriage, my parents told us that they were divorcing. My father came out as gay. Turns out, my parents had been fighting for their marriage for years leading to this decision. And when they announced that they couldn't care for Sarah anymore, it was foreshadowing their divorce and all that was to follow. And in my mind, I know that Sarah probably wouldn't have fared well throughout the divorce and its aftermath. I know for certain that my mom could not and would not have gone down the path of healing and self-discovery that she needed to save her own life if she would have been forever bound to a child who needed special care for their entire life. My mom couldn't make that sacrifice, as it would have taken her from her other kids, and she had to find a way to survive. My dad's journey was just beginning, and it was hard to see how any of us fit into it, much less a mentally and physically disabled daughter. As with war, accidents, deaths, and tragedies, crime, and loss, we accept that there will be casualties. You can't drop a bomb on a village and expect no dogs to die. Sarah was the casualty of my family's separation. She's gone now. I'm telling this story so I can bring her back, somehow, in some way, because I don't know where she is. When my parents divorced, we got torn up like a piece of paper and thrown into the wind. We scattered, emotionally and physically. My oldest brothers left home, my mom moved to New York City with two younger brothers, and I stayed behind with the baby of the family to live with my dad and his new male partner. It didn't occur to me to look for Sarah amongst all the other many lost things. What would I have done if I had found her? I couldn't hang on to anything. I never stopped worrying about her, though, and I will always desperately wonder. Recently, I started searching for her again, but can seemingly learn nothing, and I likely never will. I know my mom tried a few years back, too, and only hit dead ends. I'd like to know if she's alive. Does she need help? Is she hungry? It's been over 20 years since we said goodbye to Sarah. My brothers and I ultimately recovered from the divorce, as did my parents. We began to understand and accept that my father's sexuality had been oppressed for so long that he was running out of options for himself. My mom extended such grace to him and paved a path of healing that we all followed to the point where we've been able to celebrate holidays, vacations, and weddings with both parents and their respective spouses all together. We love each other tremendously. However, we know that our collective survival came at a cost. And in my mind, the greatest loss in all of this was indeed Sarah. So now, as I sit in my warm home with my two beautiful boys and my lovely wife, we discuss adopting a child in the future. It's impossible for me to not want to try to adopt Sarah back. If she needs anything right now that I could give her, I would. If I found her, I'd keep her, if she'd have me. People took solace in assuming that Sarah's emotional maturity and ability was stunted to the point of not being able to process leaving one family to join another. And I know that makes them feel better. I just don't believe it. I think, buried in the water in her brain, clenched in her hand, embedded in the fibers of her muscles and in her long red hair, we'd find us. We'd all be there, sitting on the stairs as one family waiting for our picture to be taken on Christmas morning. We'd be there, running past her while she sits in the sandbox watching. We'd be there, stringing up her dolls from the rafters. We would be there. If I could find her, maybe I'd find us all. Bring us all back to the house that we grew up in and never wanted to leave in the first place. Thank you.
Hmm. Matt McGahey.
You've been listening to So Stories of Life, a St. Louis homegrown podcast that celebrates true life storytelling through a variety of artistic mediums. Our next live event takes place on February 11, and we're currently accepting submissions to fit the theme of I'm Standing Right Here, Stories of the Undervalued, Overlooked, and Underappreciated. If you have a story you'd like to share, you may submit a brief synopsis to so.storiesoflife@gmail.com. If your story is chosen, it could be featured on our next podcast. I'd like to take the time to thank our many volunteers and our supportive audience members who keep this little podcast alive. And now, once again, I bring you Susan Trowbridge Adams.
The next piece is called Bedtime in St. Louis. The big fresh start about that one is actually moving here. There was this guy who said, oh, hey, how about you and me fall in love? And I had like known him for 30 years or something. And I thought, yeah, okay, that's probably a good idea. Let's try that. I was a West Coast girl. The economic downturn hit me hard. I spent everything I had in savings, all my IRA money, every dime of my 401k, got my kid through high school and into college, and kicked the dust of Seattle off my feet. It's a very unaffordable town. And I came here in love, which apparently is something you can decide to be. It's much harder to decide not to be, actually. Like once you're there, I don't know if you all have noticed, falling in love, you can pick, and it's awesome. Falling out of love is excruciating and very, very difficult. This piece is called Bedtime in St. Louis. And how really does the nautical mile differ from a mile on land? It's a little bit longer and very, very much wetter. And if I take ship from the bluff like a widow's walk here in the Oregon Territory where I stand facing rain and spray right from my living room window at night, and bellow my foghorn into the morning. And then all those places, Baja, and the Panama Canal, and the Gulf, and the mighty Mississippi with all its Frenchified, busy productivity. How long then? The Mississippi is wide and thorough, and it's just the last river I can stand riding home to a city full of people who reach toward the smelting core of us. And the ladies blink and tell us stories, and the men grin and grow sleepy-eyed. The surf is tall and international on the coast, and it moves me not to beach comb or to crouch over the tide pools with my magnifying glass and my big boots, but to sail with the wind in my eyes and the salt on my tongue, yeasty and buttery and fertile. I have built a boat that can take the swell under her keel. Inside me, I crash full-throated onto the delta. I rush foaming under the bridges. I steam into a working harbor. That's Bedtime in St. Louis. Thank you.
You've been listening to So, Stories of Life, an outrageous production. So is recorded live at the Tavern of Fine Arts the second Wednesday of every month. Make your submissions now to become part of our live broadcast. Make your submissions to so.storiesoflife@gmail.com. So is recorded live by Morse Media. Be sure to join us soon for more episodes of So, Stories of Life. Thank you.